and that was, I'm back on the job. I'm not cheap. In fact, one fan club, and I was like, oh, man. All right. Do you have a story like that? You ever, were you ever so burned out and you hate, you were like, what am I doing? This is dumb. This is a waste of time, blah, blah. And then one little thing happened and it kind of brought it all back home. This is the, you know, the human interest story, the heartwarming, the kind of, and you want to kind of go for the punch and then slow down and get right in there. You got one of those? You don't have to.
I do. Do you?
I can't think of one.
I do. I got
up. Then you get the mic twice next.
Yeah.
Does everybody know their low point here? I have some knobs.
Is this it?
My low point was I had started a theater in San Francisco in 1985, and with Ellen Sebastian and Joe Lambert and Leonard Pitt. And there were four of us, and we had a partnership. And we worked together for 7 years. We opened really wonderfully because Spalding Gray opened our theater for us in Fort Mason, Life on the Water. And we were off and running, and we were doing an impossible thing. We were opening a new theater in the era of Ronald Reagan. And we were getting more support every year, although the whole time it was basically box office. We were basically we were running circles around Berkeley Rep and ACT. We got pink section covers. We brought in the Nicholas Brothers. We had a festivals all the time. We brought in people from Germany and Australia. We were just on fire. And we got bigger every year, and by the 91 and 92 area, we had started the Solomillo Festival with the climate people, Joe and Marcia, and we started quarreling. It started, you know, there was a romance at the center of the partnership. The soap opera accelerated. And I lost everything. Perfect sound. Perfect sound. It turns out that in the nonprofit world, you can work day and night and build something for years and years and years and years and years. Tour the world finding artists, you know, chasing down journalists. You know, running up on stage, introducing people, going back to the box office, collecting the money, you know, bringing people up the steps. One time the bleacher at Life on the Water actually collapsed because this fat person fell through the, you know, and we had to, like, I had to take this person all the way down to the hospital, talk this person out of suing us. You know, it's just like an independent business. You know, you just, like, work, work, work for 7 years. One board of directors vote, and it was gone. There was no equity. That's why I left San Francisco. The structure of the arts was such that I was without protection. Now with Reverend Billy, we're building it differently so that because I've learned my lesson. You know, you build it. You adopt the name of the company.
But it's not just
you
that.
You become the logo, you know.
It's not just that, really. I mean, I would
say that the big difference is actually that the work that you're doing now, or that we're doing now, is completely different. It's connected to a larger movement. It's movement building. And so, in fact, even if the nonprofit entity that we are collapsed and went away, the work still exists. And I would say that defines really the failure there. A personal failure is really different when it's when you're involved in an actual movement, when you're trying to change the world, you really can't afford to fail. And so your bad day is your bad day.
We thought we were at Life in the Water. We thought we were.
I know you did.
We also thought that was political. the kinds of people we sponsored, it was a community theater, and
If we had if we had somebody like somebody like Abner the Eccentric, somebody that you think of as not political at all, we would also have John Trudeau, and we'd have Guillermo Gomez Pena, and we would have very political people. It was a William Yellow Robe, but there wasn't a unified value system. It was producing many other people, and then kind of getting in line and producing myself once a year kind of thing. But that scared me about San Francisco. I thought, what's the protection here? How would you work that hard for that long and get to the point where there are hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant money in the queue and so forth and so on, and not have protection? In a moment, it's gone. It seems to me that there's got to be some sort of medium between, on the one hand, completely disappearing into the market and becoming an upper middle class person that no one knows about. And my example is the fine arts in New York. No one knows who they are, but they're rich. They're making very good livings. They're yuppies. There's something between that and being a flat out, community volunteer who's constantly broke. There must be something. I lost my way in San Francisco. I couldn't figure out. I'm coming back here because of the Burning Man community. Because my trust is being built with that strategy. That's the first thing that I've been a part of in San Francisco in a long time, where I started relaxing and started feeling that I can do my work, and that that somehow the reward will stick. That is the Burning Man community, the annual city, and then the decompressions and the parades, and now it's in the regions, it's becoming an annual series of rituals like an indigenous society. I'm fascinated by that. I think that's a new form that's borrowing old ritual theories and old theories of society. Just having so, and it's not based on the non-profit form. It's not based on, basically, Life on the Water was a corporation, for all our radicalism and all our fuck you-ness, we were a corporation where the people that invented the thing and built it all those years were actually vulnerable to one vote. It was posing as a corporation, but then there was no stock. There was no way to buy it, to have it actually be the possession of the people who did the work. At Burning Man, there's something else something else going on. You make your theme camp, people come and you make relationships. You make the relationships together and you make rituals together. And you can grow the ritual toward the center of a vast community. And then it goes out and becomes stories. And it goes out into a whole shadow media that is really bigger than lots of commercial media. It's bigger than Amy Goodman. It's a big parallel media to corporatized media, the kind of people that support the war and so forth. That was my low point, was losing it all. But I think my high point is coming back to the playa and discovering that it's a lot more than San Francisco now, of course. When we started Life in the Water in 85, 86, just around the bend, down down to just around the other side of the bridge there, the beginnings of the first driftwood 2x4 burns were taking place.
About that same time. Just on the other side of the bridge.
Yeah, just around the corner.
Let's do it again. Let's change. Let's completely change gears. Savitri, can you name me a circus performer? A famous one from years ago. Sure you can.
Lola Montez.
Yeah, there you go. Can anyone else name a circus performer? Famous circus performer? Yes?
Larry Persone.
There it is. How about a famous a group of tightrope walkers?
Willendos.
Thank you.
Yes.
Anybody know who Johnny Eck is? No arms, no legs.
Is he the guy in Coney Island?
No, he was the guy in the movie Freaks. Kind of, whatever, anyway. So it was a thing that used to happen that the circus performers used to be performers. They were like, they were famous people. You know, they were celebrities and stuff. Here's a good question for you, Savitri. Can you name one of the Cirque du Soleil performers?
Well, I had a friend named Danny who was a dancer in
I had a friend named Danny who was a dancer in Cirque du Soleil, but I only know him, I knew him before that, because I don't think he was a runaway Mormon, actually. Kind of a great story. He was the eldest of 9 Mormon children, and he ran away and joined the circus.
Whoa. Do you know that Cirque du Soleil doesn't allow the names of their performers to be let out, that the performers are mostly anonymous, and they're there to wear makeup and masks so that they can't be recognized and stuff, so that their positions can be easily replicated?
It's true. I've never noticed in any programs or anything. You're right.
So it's kind of an interesting thing where, like, artistically, like, you would think that, like, Cirque du Soleil is, like, this hip, like, art thing, blah, 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 but, like, it's the McDonald's of circus. It's like, you know, where, like, your position is replaced. Someone else gets in the costume and do that snake thing, and that's it. What do you think of that as far as, like, corporate consumerism, blah, blah, blah? Does that resonate?
I mean, Cirque du Soleil right now is trying to take over a whole block in New York and trying to tear down a bunch of old small theaters to build themselves a big Las Vegas style showroom. So, obviously, that anonymity is working against the people.
Cash register?
They have more than one cash register. But I will say that I think there is something to be gained from performers who don't necessarily have to have credit all the time. And this is something I've learned working with the Stop Shopping Choir, actually for myself personally, that there's a lot of pleasure to be, a lot of the times when we're working, no one knows who we are, no one knows our names, we don't have programs when we have shows, and there are people in our group who really resist that and resent it, actually, because they feel like, well, we should get credit, you know, we're volunteering our time, our names are important. And then I go back and forth because I think actually there's a gift you give there when you just do it because you want to do it without the credit, without that return, without the applause necessarily. I think there's a good balance, and I think you have to have both. But another question when you're asking about corporatized art. I mean, obviously, Cirque du Soleil has drawn a lot of people to this circus arts as well, and is definitely a place where a lot of performers I know have worked. And
Starbucks has brought a lot of people, you know.
I know.
To coffee, you know?
Absolutely, it has. It absolutely has. And so now that it's there, what do you do? I mean, what do you do about something like Cirque du Soleil? Do you shut it down? Do you say like this is? Is it bad necessarily? I mean, at this point, I'm trying to achieve a kind of diversity. I think like, well, Cirque du Soleil might be okay if there's like one show a year. You know, if there are 20 shows a year and that's the only circus anyone can see, and it monopolizes every space and every possible ticket that anyone's going to buy that goes to the circus or, takes over city blocks in New York. I don't know. That sucks. You know, definitely. But again, I mean, there's a lot of people who would look at, I have these incredibly sophisticated German friends in New York, and it's their favorite show of the year, and they go, and they take 100 people every year, and the 100 people who go have never gone to anything like that, and I know for a fact that a number of them, as a result of going to Cirque du Soleil, then start going to smaller circus things in New York City, and even sort of starting to become aficionados of the circus. So, you know, Do I think there's another way those people would get there? Is it more important that they get there than that Cirque du Soleil exists? I don't know. I mean, I think in a way you start driving yourself crazy. They're there. They exist. And so better to promote the other ones, I think, and hope that people will get bored eventually with Cirque du Soleil.
So,
May I add something?
Yeah.
Mr. Chicken?
Yes, sir.
The Cirque du Soleil is simply depoliticized. They excite a radical response in me. They're depoliticized. And the fact is that we have such an emergency right now, from the individual up to the climate crisis. We're facing something that's completely different right now. And that kind of end times fact is forcing a kind of apocalyptic aesthetic for me. I really dismiss things that are depoliticized. You're part of the problem. Remember, you're too young to remember, back in the 60s, you used to say, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. And we're getting to that point right now. You actually have to,
I think that's fundamentalist. I mean,
I think that's a fundamentalist position. I think that you can say that, but are you going to live that way? I mean, you can say that all you want. I don't know. What are you going to do tomorrow? I mean, I don't know if it's possible that way. I mean, if the question is, do you want things like Cirque du Soleil around? Obviously, no, but are you going to expend your energy even talking about it at this point? I don't really want to anymore.
Okay. Let's Well, I mean, we're picking on Canadians.
Retain a sense of humor? Is that what you're saying?
Since we're picking on Canadians, let's just go pick on a couple more, because it's so easy. Are there any Canadians in the room? I'll say it slow. Thank you. So, do you feel...
Do you know how to spell Canada?
No.
Yes. He's from Minnesota, he can't help it.
Hey man, you're from Minnesota?
You want C-A-N-A-D-A.
So, do you, this question is for Savagery because you've talked too much. Hand it over.
Can I get a drink?
Yes.
Yes. How are we out here? How are things going?
So Savitri, do you feel that AtBusters is really a name that you can trust in anti-advertising?
Well, I should say that I think it's a really slick magazine. That would be my answer.
No, you don't want to get into that at all? I mean, AdBusters is really a name that you can trust. I mean, as far as anti-establishment, logo. No, wait a minute. What's anti? But how's it?
It's an anti-consumer magazine from Vancouver area, yes. Right? Who founded By Nothing Day?
Yes.
Which I mean, Billy happens to really believe in By Nothing Day. I believe that these one-day things, like don't shop for a day, is just really silly. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, we do it. We work really hard at it every year. We try to get people engaged with it. But, I mean, the whole idea that you could just not do something once a year is, it's utopian and peculiar to me. So.
Where did Billy go?
I don't know, but I hope you didn't hear what I said.
Where'd he go?
He's leaving now. He's leaving now.
Well,
versus
the compact?
Versus, yeah, the compact is, obviously, that's a... I guess you guys probably all know because you live here about the compacts. These are people who've basically taken a vow not to buy things. And I think there's a few things they can buy, essential food items and underwear. And some people are on another third year, I think, of the compact. So, I mean, it takes a lot of discipline to do that. It's a pretty aesthetic decision to make. But obviously, it's fantastic. They've gotten huge amounts of press. I mean, they've been on the Today Show, and I think they were on Oprah, and all kinds of people are talking about it.
Do they say the clippings?
Yeah, I'm sure they do. There's a guy in New York called No Impact Man, and he has a weblog. But it's actually his job. He gets paid to make No Impact. So he has a really big book deal, and they're paying him to have zero impact. So they make no trash. Every day they make like this much compost in New York City. This is pretty hard to do, actually. And it's kind of in line with the compact.
Right.
Yeah, but I think these efforts are, I think they're good. They send a really big symbolic message out to people. But I think that we have to work a little bit more incrementally and realistically. I come from a commune in New Mexico, where we were off the grid in 1964. And, so I definitely know this idea that you could, leave it all behind, start over and do something completely pure, and I just don't believe in purity. I think it's it leads to dangerous fundamentalism and self-righteousness.
Fundamentalism.
No, so you're not a fundamentalist.
You're a preacher. You're a fake preacher.
So those are my questions. That was all I had prepared. I tried to come up with an interesting batch of questions. We have a couple of questions from the crowd. We don't want to make this too long and stuff, but do you have a question there?
I do. So, Billy, you were arrested for reciting the First Amendment.
Yes, ma'am.
And when you were talking about your low point, about how you worked so hard to create your theater, I kept thinking about when you were reciting the First Amendment, you're in jail because you recited the First Amendment. That seems like, talk about pulling your protections out from underneath you. It just seemed like a kind of a corollary
point. I just want to talk about the First Amendment for 1 second. I want to tell you that that's like a high point. The First Amendment is a high point. And,
yes.
And getting arrested for anything related to that is the best feeling in the world. It's the most ennobling,
how long does it
feeling.
Take to recite the First Amendment?
Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech,
or of the press,
or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for redress of grievances.
Amen.
44 words, children. 5 freedoms. 1 sentence. Some semicolons, but...
I have a question here.
Yes.
What's your name, sir?
My name's Harry.
Hello, Harry.
Yes. And I wanted.
Please don't stand up. I just like to tell people what to do.
Yes,
I'm
of course.
The mayor, you know?
Why would you want to be mayor if you wouldn't want to tell somebody
I'll stand
what
up for
to
you.
Do? That's the job.
I'm your mayor. I'm here.
Exactly.
For you.
Okay. Exactly.
You got a mic. I'll hold your mic.
Thanks. Having seen Cirque du Soleil, it seemed to me that it was more of a high-tech type of performance. And perhaps rather soulless. I won tickets. I had no idea what it was. It was a huge tent near where Pac Bell Park is now. It was a long time ago. And also, I think that with regard to the current situation, one of the biggest problems is that just building period is expensive, and people's wages haven't really gone up enough to match the cost of housing. So even if a landlord has a place, it does cost a lot of money to do the repairs. So it's not just that they're gouging. As far as Adbusters goes, Adbusters has some good products, such as a flag with corporate logos on it. And at the same time, you know, I visited their offices in Vancouver. They're just a small little nonprofit foundation. They're not really, they have to live too. So, and they have to probably strike a balance from what they have in their magazine, what they don't. I haven't seen it in a while. And I was wondering what your opinion was about, there's a lawsuit going on with Burning Man, and I understand there's a lot of money because they're charging, Burning Man is still kind of an elitist event in terms of the amount of money you have to spend to get there and get in. And I was wondering if you had any comment about that whole situation.
No, I don't really. I don't think it's not an interesting question to me politically. Like I just have no way to engage with it. You know, I have no way to engage with it. I don't. Everything I know about it, I hear in ways like this. I don't know. I really don't know anything about it, and so I feel like it's an undermining question. And I respect the question, but I have no answer at all to it.
I don't know enough about it. I think. I don't know.
Take me out for beers sometime.
We have a lot of friends who find a way to get there, regardless of the expense. And we have there's a whole culture of folks that contribute in different ways. They get there. They live together and share and drive down the expense.
Oh, is that what your question is? Why
well, my question is that it seems,
I was just talking to the elitist event phrase.
The fact that from what I read in the paper. Larry Harvey's made a lot of money, or is making a lot of money off of this event, and there's a lawsuit by these other people.
Do you want to answer that?
Your host can tell you more about it than me.
Do you want me to tell you if Larry Harvey makes a lot of money? Do you want me to right now? I'll tell you. Ready? No. We're going to move on. We got another question right here.
Thank you.
You.
I was just wondering if,
yes,
Billy,
yes, sir.
Are there a few things in particular that kind of drove you into this anti-consumerist kind of crusade? And I just want to mention that Hannah Montana tickets are $2,400 right now.
Wow.
Say that, Hannah Montana.
Hannah Montana. $2,400.
What's Hannah Montana?
It's a like a new musical
Disney teenage TV show.
It's like a tween TV show, and they made a Broadway musical out of it.
$2,400 for one ticket to a Broadway musical?
No. It's a kid concert. She gets up.
Wow.
It's Tiffany.
So
you
really,
just show your age, right?
So really,
there.
rich parents would buy such a ticket for their child. Wow.
So I had a question there, lady in the back.
I'm from Europe, and what was most shocking for me to come here to the city was how unaffordable the arts are, actually. Because I mean, when I looked at the prices for the opera or for any theater or for the day, it's completely unaffordable.
Yeah,
it's completely different from situation most of the time in Europe. So what do you think about that? I was very surprised that you didn't have those.
Well, the funding structure is totally different, obviously, here than it is in Europe. I mean, yeah, you can go to see, but my aunt went to a concert at the conservatory last night that was $7. So you can go see things, obviously. It's just apples and oranges. The United States and European art funding, there's just no way to even, I mean, there's an evolution problem here in the United States. But I would say that you can see incredible art here that you just have to expand your idea of what art is. I don't think there's any shortage of art to see. You have to have a less narrow, not you personally, a one has to have a less narrow view of what seeing art is, and there's free art. I mean, just sitting on the street sometimes on a Saturday afternoon here is better art than you see in a museum a lot of times, obviously. So, but there's, I mean, I think that the struggle I have in the United States about arts funding is that a lot of those big groups get a lot of funding. I mean, the ballets and the orchestras, and then
they're
and
taking
then
like 92% of the entire arts budget.
And then there's no way for us to go see. It's not subsidized for us, so that's
ballet,
really
opera, and symphony. Those three things are taking 92% of the 12% hotel tax.
It's
San Francisco. So we're gonna go to Kiko, and then we're gonna go to you.
So I saw your movie last night, and I thought it was pretty great. I want to approach it from a third world perspective. I'm from Brazil, and I get your message, I really do. But on the other hand, I kind of feel that this country had to go through that glut in consumption and prosperity to reach a point that we're just so glutted that could actually afford to become, to start asking these existential questions about overconsumption.
It's not an existential question. It is not an existential question. It's not. I mean, just want to assure you of that.
Right.
Go ahead.
So, while the rest of the world hasn't gotten to that point yet, I remember when I moved from Brazil to here, and I went to the supermarket for the first time, and I saw the cereal, breakfast cereal section, and I was like, whoa, in Brazil we have like two kinds, like the coconut one. and it's almost, you know, that's a prosperous country here. So when I see, I do get your message.
The coconut
but
one.
What do you say?
I'm going to be saying that for years now.
So, but, you know, when you see the rest of the world was trying to basically improve their economic conditions, right, in China, or in India, or Brazil, and they really want those Nike sneakers, they really want to have to own a Hummer someday, and they really want to have a big house in the suburbs, they really do. I don't feel like I can really fault them for wanting that. So what do you say to the rest of the world who hasn't gone through this prosperity cycle like the U.S. has? What, you know, how do you think
we hope it's a cautionary tale. We hope that, that you can see that the empire is eating itself, and that, yeah, of course, the desire to have those things is totally understandable.
But it got us where we are now.
Exactly. Late-stage capitalism, I mean, it's only a matter of time before no one can afford to live in Sao Paulo. And where are those people going to go? You know what I'm saying? If those megacities face the problems that even a small city in the United States is facing right now at this stage in capitalism, it's unimaginable, really.
I'm not so sure that I would. On the one hand, the planet simply cannot allow India and China to become the next United States and then discover that they made a mistake. We can't make some of the mistakes we have made again. Whichever tribe of human beings it is, we have now, we need to stop our consumption. Around the world, we have to change our consumption addiction. And we just must, all human beings must teach all other human beings how to do it. We just have to, we have to be rude to each other. We have to entertain each other. We have to trip each other. We have to pay each other to stop. We have to find ways to slow down consumption, because otherwise it is the end. I mean, the wind and the air, the floods and the fires, I mean, we're getting very direct communicating right now, very articulate, not ambiguous, from the life system of which we're a part. We have to listen to that. India and China can't go through the late stage capitalism evolution. We can't, the planet will not survive that. And so, you know, some people are really, really trying to open up that communication, find another way to go. I would contest your summary that the rest of the world wants to do what we did. I'm not so sure that that's, it seems to me that much of South America has pulled out of the globalized free trade agreements, yeah, which are basically colonialization. There are economies springing up everywhere that are in direct opposition to the basic, you know, World Trade Organization program of Davos. You know, I mean, there's a revolution going on right now. Whether it's enough, whether it's happening fast enough, I don't know. But there's much opposition now in play. Amen.
So I got a question here. I'd like to just say one thing. I was in Tibet renting a car, and the kid found out that I was in show business and closed the door and did karaoke to the Backstreet Boys. It was like a really long song, and then when he was done, he asked me if he had any talent. That was,
did you give him a gig? I mean, did he want a gig?
Yeah, I put him on the next flight right to Hollywood to be working a car wash. I had a question here first, and then you.
I was just going to try to sum up a little differently. You started off talking about how our public space is disappearing, and then you talked about an art space that you built up, and it was, the rug was easily pulled out from under you because you didn't own the art space. It was run by the city and probably paying your rent to the guys who own San Francisco. It's probably, what's his face, Sean Steve or something. Like
that. One of those, yeah.
And then you talked about the festival of Burning Man, which takes place in a desert which is uninhabitable. It's sort of like we get to exist for a free period in a virtual space. And all of that, all of those things is something we need to take our shit back from the landlords who own our life. Sure.
Exactly.
And I think it needs to happen more than in a place like Burning Man is a part-time festival. It needs to happen in our cities. That we take back our art spaces, we take back somehow property so that we can live cheaper and exist as artists as much as possible.
I totally agree with you. I think that all of our work always comes right down to that very issue. It always comes down to defensive property. And everything that we've done in the last 10 years, the drama, the tragedy, the failures, and the successes all take place over a property line. And it's unbelievable that we're still this retarded. You know what I mean? That we're still actually fighting over a border. But we are. That's where we are. That's what this country was founded on. Defensive property is the basis for our government structure, our corporate structure. It's what we do. It's what the police do. It's what the government does. It's what the laws do. And I agree. I mean, that's what the work
South
we have
America
in front of us.
And Central America know that struggle. That's yeah. Why they're not getting the shit taken away from them.
That's mm-hmm. Right. That's right.
We're going to take, I want to take two more questions. Two or three more questions. Okay, we'll start with you.
Has your church considered forming coalitions with recyclers, with the compact people, and even churches who agree with your message of stewardship? Have you connected with people like this as you travel?
Well, we connected with Compact. They are saints in our church, and we're saints in their church. We connect with like thinking groups. We don't have an infrastructure building capacity. We don't have an office. We don't write grants. I mean, it's Savitri and me, and you know our cell phones and our two computers. I mean, we don't have a we're guerrilla types, and maybe that's you know that's so. The theory is to be, and then, we both come out of theater. We both come out of bureaucratized theater and offices, and we both have seen organization ideas of professionalization of theater groups and theatrical producing organizations destroy what actually happens on stage. And so there's a certain a default position we go to, which is, you know, we end up back in the thrift store of the arts. You know, we end up being not consumers of the arts ourselves, not consumers of the art world ourselves, because we come from our home art form turned out to be a lie, you know, and so we try to keep tearing it down. Trying to stay out in public space. What am I saying?
It's okay. I know what you're saying.
I think that we broke coalition this way.
Come back.
By essentially talking.
Fill this with wine.
And listen. But we don't have. We don't have a format for official. Coalition building now, but we, of course, those are the groups we work with a lot. We invite us places, and we go to where the problem is, essentially, and build around the problem. So there are always church groups or community groups there. Or, yeah, that would be. Yes,
I'd like to just say that coalition building, I don't recommend it. Doesn't work for me. You want to collaborate with a guy like me? Doesn't work.
Oh, thank you.
And then this guy, and we'll do Katie. It's our last question. What's your name?
My name is Todd.
Is it hard to shave like that? It looks hard. I mean, I just...
It's not going to last.
Okay.
It's a living thing.
Yeah, it changes. So, what I see in a lot of the things that we're talking about is, we talk about the arts, but I think the substance of it all is creativity. We all want to see creativity come into how everything is run. So Burning Man is a society of everything is run creativity. Art sparks it, creativity in everything, bringing creativity to movement. And I see that like lacking in, it's not given a lot of importance in schools. I'm working in high school.
Yeah.
Oh, right. So I wonder if you can comment on that, and maybe some sort of prayer to bring us towards.
Pray for that, for sure.
Well, I see the when I'm around the Burning Man people, of which, of course, we have Lady B in the front row, so I'm a little self-conscious here. But I feel the conversation almost always turns to the other 51 weeks of the year. There's this dynamic between the city on the playa and the regions and the decompressions and the you know, David Best is in Detroit now, creating a community-based like 8-square-block kind of radical Jesus space. It's a crazy thing that he's working on with the folks there. That 1 week is coming back into our, we're discovering how to carry it back into our lives. In New York City, we haven't really carried the playa back. We haven't known yet how to have. We're among the weakest regional area. You know, the regionals, the New York regionals are among the weakest. You know, Seattle, Boston. You know, there's some fantastic burgeoning cultures in the other 51 weeks. In New York, we basically end up in warehouses just drunk. It's not that different than club life, you know.
Ding-a-ling-a-ling.
Can I have a drink? I mean, it's not that different than club life itself. And I think that we have vertical buildings that go up into the sky, that creating these canyons, and then we're a walking city trying to walk through a sort of Ventura effect, you know, the reducing, you know, the walls come in and you like appear at an intersection and you like just crunch into people. And that's our theater, is basically collision. It's much more interesting in New York walking the streets than the idea that the programmers have had of creating our decompression rituals. It's going into different places, different ways. The schools. I see corporations just hunting the schools. Whether it's the cool hunters like standing out in the yards, or like taking notes on what kind of, you know, what kind of clothing the kids are wearing in the Bronx so that they can sell that up on giant Calvin Klein billboards 2 weeks later, or whether it's Channel 2 getting teaching people the number 6 by having 6 Nabisco cookies on the screen. The corporations are just the kids are the market. I mean, that's what we try to do, show in our movies.
We had an amazing experience, two of them on Long Island, but I'll just tell you one, I'll tell you as fast as I can tell you. We went out to Hofstra University to do a gig for a bunch of anthropologists, and a conference of collective behavior anthropologists, and we went out with about 12 of us went out to do this evening gig for them to perform. So we arrived there, and it was summer, and people were a little out of it, and it was like, oh, just go over there, get dressed over there, you know. So we went in this room, and we were changing in there, and then this fleet of small children, middle school-aged children came in and said, oh, we're in here because we're waiting for our bus, so you have to go now. And we're like, oh, okay. So then we left there, we were down in some hallway trying to get dressed down there, and then, so we did, and we were all ready to go on stage, we did our sound check, and then I looked over, and there were like 4 cops, and a plainclothes cop walking towards us, and I mean, that happens to us a lot, so I was like, oh, that doesn't look good at all. And they came and they took Billy and they pushed him against a wall and they said, we gotta talk to you, we have to talk to you now. And they started walking away with him. They were really manhandling him, and I was trying to think, well, what the hell is going on here? And they were actually pushing him hard right away without announcing anything. I go to this room of collective behavior sociologists and anthropologists, like, excuse me, we're being arrested, could someone help us here? And this whole room of professors just stared at the phenomenon going over there, and Billy's being dragged out by 5 cops, and I'm like, screaming and interfering, and they're saying, this is private property, you have, weren't you just in the bathroom, what were you doing in the bathroom, they were saying to Billy, and we go out, they just haul him away, I mean, he's gone, and he's gone, and there's no show, and the professors sort of come out eventually, and what's going on here, and I have no idea. And we go over to the cop house, and they tell us, well, we had a report that there was a man in the woman's bathroom. And of course, Billy was in the bathroom with 3 members of the Stop Shopping Gospel Choir, women, and they were doing their hair, as showbiz people tend to do before they go on stage. And I guess there happened to be a cheerleader camp going on at the same time. So you can imagine this scenario, right? Like, the 2 teenage girls walk in, they're like, there's a guy in the, what's that guy doing? And he's dressed like a priest, and oh my God, there's a freaky priest in the bathroom. So they go tell the cops, and the cops arrest Billy, and there's no, the climate of fear and the climate of repression is so intense on campuses and around young people right now. So they were protecting their consumer dollars. This cheerleading camp brings in a huge amount of money to that university.
So I mean, to me, it's about high schools because I feel like the fear about what happens to those kids, and of course, with increasing violence on campuses too and at schools, so there's this whole other kind of fear that's pervasive, and it's at odds with creative life. It's hard to be creative when you're really scared, you know, and that goes for the kids, but especially I think for the teachers who really, and if you're one, I you know, really offer you deep compassion right now dealing with that, because you know, you are afraid for yourself and for them, and you're also afraid of this system that's about to shut you down at any second for doing anything that could offend anyone even a little bit. So, good luck, brother. Really, good luck.
The end of that story is I was let go at about the point the show would have ended. And it felt a lot like just censorship. So there was a local radical was performing in the Student Activities Center pretty near a highly profitable cheerleading camp.
Kind of funny.
And they basically detained me within 2 or 3 minutes of the beginning of the show and let me go about 80 minutes later, at about the point the show would have ended, having finally just received a common sense explanation of what happened. You know? We simply thought that part of the building was closed and it was the only place we could
the men's bathroom was
get
locked.
Our
was
stuff together, and we had been promised a dressing room. And hallelujah. Well,
let's take one last question and then do something else with the rest of our evening.
Hello over there. How are you doing?
Standing. The left wing.
Standing. It's the left wing.
Yeah. There they are.
Well, there's a question in the left wing.
We already have a question in the queue. Unless Katie would like to give her question to a PhD scientist.
Fuck you.
Oh, sorry. The pressure is on. I mean, he's just a PhD scientist who measures worms for a living.
Fuck you, PhD.
It's the yoga instructor versus the scientist. Okay, well, we'll go ahead. We'll listen to your question. What is it? Better be good.
You know what? I'm going to give it to him. But I will tell you that I'm not just a yoga instructor, that I moved here in 1992 and worked for the San Francisco Art Commission. I was the first art employee of the new granting program, the Cultural Equity Arts granting program that came out of all the slap with the hotel tax. I know a fucking lot about this, and I actually knew Bill when he had his other theater. And so that's it. I will give my question away.
No. I insist.
Sitting through this has been a fascinating and amazing. And I was telling Bill outside, it's difficult. I don't know the answers. And it was great to sit around talking about all of this stuff tonight, but I didn't have any of the answers to the questions that made me leave. A, the granting community. Yeah. B, nearly all of the arts. And C, I feel like I am a second class citizen living in a town that I've lived in almost, you know, a good third of my life, if not a little bit more than that. And that I have chosen to do certain things in my life that are not in the mainstream. I cannot afford to live here. I feel, yeah, it's fucked up. Yeah. It's more than fucked up. And I appreciate what you're trying to do. You know, as far as the arts community, arts is a part of my life like this. Yeah. Like, I can't separate it, okay? So I'm always going to have to sit down and have a conversation like this about the arts. What this is about is soul. What this is about is, like, you can name, this has been like a whack-a-mole game tonight. Like, everything you're talking about is like, yes, yes, yes. We're all running around spreading our thoughts out to all these various issues. They are all at the heart of it. It is a crisis of faith. It is spiritual bankruptcy. I am totally convinced of it. It's offensive to me on the deepest level. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I know how to get out of it is humor and art. Mm-hmm. Creative mm-hmm. spirit. And that's mm-hmm. it. Circus, all of that, you know, it's the only thing that I believe in anymore, and I barely believe in it anymore. And I'm at a low point.
Yeah.
So help me.
But Katie, what about your fan club?
You know.
Yeah.
You can't quit art, Katie. What about your fan club?
I mean, and you would have quit already if you could, and that's the thing. I mean, what I was saying to Billy, like, you know, if you're trying to change the world, you can't afford to fail. I mean, and that can hold you up for a long time.
It has stopped a lot of things. But what I see is, like, I've been here a long fucking time, and there are a lot of really interesting things going on, but ultimately they're all falling the way of the stuff that just can't be tolerated. And I just don't know what to do anymore. Yes, it is about money. But I mean, the only thing we have to do is convince people with money that we got what they don't have, which is soul. We understand why we're here, and they don't. But more and more, that's what I think. I mean,
it's inarguable that if they keep coming and keep buying $2 million studio condominiums, then we're all going to be priced out. We're not going to want to be here.
Point, it's either like it's the things that you're proposing and the things that you're proposing, or I'm nearly gone.
But I just want to issue kind of a plea, I guess, to you, as someone who is sophisticated and probably knows a lot of different kinds of people, that it's capitalism is going to do this to us. It is going to tear us apart inside of our own communities. You see it all over. You see artists fighting producers. You see teachers fighting artists. You see artists fighting artists over little scraps. And this is what is happening to us, and it is up to us to reach across that, and we have to. You have to be strong about it.
But it's been happening here a lot longer than it's been happening in New York or LA, and I know this because I grew up in LA and I moved to New York from here and moved back here. And the thing that I see is that there's never been enough money for the arts here, as far as, like, in LA there's a certain amount of theater and movie production that is a certain amount of creative work that makes money. And New York too, New York has hope. York has hope that, like, this place has never had, because you could be sitting on the subway, you could be sitting next to a guy with a big bag of money on the subway. He might like your idea, and it's just, there's a hope, there's a myth and a hope there. Here, there's always been very little money and all about just, like, the spirit of, like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna do
this. No, but I'm telling you, you have to get out of the market. Your mind is in the market. No. It's like, if your mind is trapped in the market, that's where it's staying.
Here's what I want to do. I want to think about how that I can choose to make a living and pay the things that I need to know I have to pay in my life to go forward in a capitalist society, living as modestly as I can, and make money the way I want to make money. I do not want to work a corporate job in order to do my art.
Right.
I do not want to work at a pizza place
right.
in order to do my
right.
art. I changed my whole life. I quit everything. I became a yoga teacher. I make fucking pot food. Do you know, drugs and sex are still the only thing that pays in this
country. Okay, well, look, there might be a revolution in the art.
But let me tell you something, that the thing that is interesting to me is that I got out of the funding game when John Kreidler, who used to run the San Francisco Foundation, wrote a report my last year I worked at the Art Commission about the funding history of San Francisco and the funding history nationally of arts. And it was very interesting because
totally below par, San Francisco, right?
Yes, no, but not just that. It was the whole fact of the matter was that this was an idea that started with the Kennedy administration and the NEA, and that basically by the mid-90s when I was working there, it was a great idea that kind of just petered out. It wasn't, when you go back to this whole report, and I urge you to look into this report, it was really fascinating. It talked about family-run theaters and small, I'm not talking about capitalist machine. I'm talking about the small, how art organizations used to be run before the 60s. And then what happened was by the time I got to San Francisco, there were a lot of pissed off artists because there were a bunch of money came into this town in the 60s and 70s. Part of the reason that you had the problem that you had at Life on the Water, I feel, was that it was just a bad plan all the way along. A lot of money came in, the whole thing blew up. I was party to 25-year-old arts organizations and theaters, Asian American Theater Company, closing their doors after 25 years. This was 15 years ago, 12, 13 years ago. You know, it was sort of like that nobody had a great plan about it and that it just sort of petered out. It was kind of nobody's fault. It's just that a bunch of money had gone into programming, nobody gave you money for staff, infrastructure, nobody knew how to do books, nobody knew how to do facilities. And you know who taught me a lot about this? It's Jack Davis, who died a week and a half ago. That man is a legend.
that man knew what was up and taught me mostly everything that I knew about this
but
stuff.
I think it's important so right these, now, though, you have to know, like you're talking about, I don't want to have a corporate job to do my art. So you know what? I have to say, at this point in our culture, it can't be about you. It's about what the fuck is happening to the planet. And I just say to you, look, between you and all of us, and I'm just using you because you're sitting there talking to me, but, you know, all of us have to put off.
Yeah, but I would disagree with you to say you said that there was always almost everything that you come down to is the line of the property line. But what I think I actually think the line moves all the time, and it's why it's what keeps us hot between all of us. We all believe in everything. I'm sure everyone in this whole room is understanding what we're talking about. And I don't want to get into this anymore. We've all been here a long time. But what I will say, I'm offering you. I'm saying I'm stopped around all of this. And you can say that I need to just be more active, you know, that's socially. But all I'm saying is it's a balance with everything about me taking care of me. I've taken care of a lot of people for a lot of years, and I'm starting to realize that I'm 38 years old, I'm broke, and I don't have a lot except what I've seen. And I don't know what to do with it anymore.
Well, this is what I just want to, let me help, just finish what I'm trying to say.
Not help me,
this,
help us in that framework.
I'm trying to say that we are now experiencing what other cultures have experienced from this culture always. And we're just getting it now.
Yep.
You know, and the empire is on us now.
Yep.
And so there's a period of time in which we're still going to have food and it's going to be all right. But Ho Chi Minh and his people sat for 5 years starving with their weapons buried underground, waiting. You know, so I would just caution you and say there's a certain amount of discipline to have about it, a certain amount of patience that is hard for Americans to have, period, and courage that you will be fine. And it might not feel good.
I mean, I think that what we all suffer from basically at our core, everyone in this room, is that we're socialists in a capitalist country. I mean, I think in large part, a lot of the things, I mean, I'm not maybe straight up strict, but a lot of the things that we believe in, a lot of kind of cooperation, a lot of kind of things, like if I have extra, I give it to the next person. Almost everyone that I know personally in this room feels that way.
A lot of the arts community moves like a socialist
progress. That is an angst, that's a pain, that's a deep pain that I don't know can be reconciled.
I'm gonna be the bad guy and stop this off, but did everybody know Katie Bell?
Thank you, Katie.
You know her now.
The myth of coming to a city at I'm an artist, I'm going to go to that city. I'm going to go to Berlin, I'm going to go to New York, I'm going to go to San Francisco. The myth of going to a city as an artist. And then if you go to that city when the blood is really running in the streets, you build up an artistic tradition in that city of some kind through your work. And then if you're successful enough, you make the city valuable. And people with lots of money start pressuring the real estate values with the rent they're able to pay. That cycle, and then once again,
music.
The soundtrack's perfect.
Do you not know Kero?
I do now.
Let's hear it.
We are now really traumatized.
You're saying evil can evil. So
that
cycle.
That cycle, we don't have a real answer to that basic problem that is the opponent of the arts more than anything else. That single phenomenon kills the arts. It's the same thing as corporate sponsorship for the arts. It's simply capitalized value seeks out, like a predator, seeks out creativity and freezes it and markets it. And that, I don't have a solution for that. But what I started doing when I fell out of the arts was I started acting out in the seams between the corporations. I adopted the sidewalk preacher character.
That's like a circus. We've been talking about the circus tonight. It's like a circus character. It happens to be an icon of right-wing politics in this country. The 3 a.m. Trinity Broadcasting Network televangelist. But starting to make shapes and gestures, just believing that it's all dead. And I'm going to start by working the sidewalks, the alleys, the parks, the lobbies. I'm going to just be around that private property line, just kind of walking it like a mushy tightrope, just kind of being there, screaming, and once in a while I get arrested. The fact is that people started doing it with me, and the fact is that lots of people are now doing that. They're seeking that place. They're finding that seam. It's basically the military strategy of the corporations that is not making sense. It's what they have not figured out. There are places where human people, bodies, flesh, can go and make performance and blow the whole thing up. And the funny thing is that journalists follow us down these slipstreams. And we give them language, and sometimes they make fun of us, oftentimes they don't. Especially right now, because they are against the war, ashamed of their role in it. They are quite aware of the climate crisis. They have their own neighborhood, which has been destroyed by chain stores and big boxes, and gentrification. I can't say that this report I'm making of public space performance is a way to make a living. I can't say that. I can't say it's a way that you can count on making a living. I do believe that it's necessary, and it gives the sort of accidental audiences around us a kind of hope.
Great answer.
I think we're going to stop on hope. I want to thank you, Secretary and Billy, for being in conversation with us. So, Karen, can you play something to change the mood around a little bit? You
guys, how about some gospel music?
You guys are welcome to stick around for as long as you'd like. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, everybody.